Hey there! Pull up a chair next to Dee Fish, speaker, author, business coach, basically all-around professional talker. As he spends a few minutes chatting with some of today's top entrepreneurs, writers, artists, salespeople, and executives. They might discuss their favorite craft brews, or the cutting edge of business technology, or what's playing on their headphones. Who knows where the conversation will take them. So grab a glass and join us for beer, beats, and business.
Really work on controlling your mind and not letting yourself dwell on those negative frequencies so often. Like, you, the dial is right there. It's literally at your whim. You control your mind. You can literally make that decision on the dime.
That was Del Dominguez, president of LickChop SEO and Mambo instructor extraordinaire at Mixed Motion Art in Chicago. I'm David J.P. Fisher, but everyone just calls me D. Fish. And welcome to Beer, Beats, and Business. Del, how are you today?
I'm good, my friend. How are you?
You know, I'm living the dream.
Awesome.
So glad to have you on today. So excited to talk about dancing, about music, and about SEO.
Yeah,
right?
My pleasure. I know. How did those things even go together?
I know, right? But here's my question.
Sure.
You know, kind of like when I was in a band, I know that there's a lot of work that people don't see when you put on a performance.
Sure.
So talk to me about what goes into a 3 or 4 minute salsa performance. Talk to me about everything that goes into that.
Well, there's a lot. So for example, I mean, even just from the perspective of a 3 or 4 minute salsa performance, you got to understand that traditionally, if you're going to do something that long, it's most likely going to be with a group of people as opposed to just with a partner. So if I'm doing something with my main partner, Laura, that's going to be probably like about a 2 minute, 220 performance. A, because we're going like 100 miles an hour, and B, because just to keep people wanting more. Now, in regards to a longer performance with a group, there's so much that goes into that, not only in just the general choreography that we have to create, but just breaking down the song, cutting the music, really taking everything, you know, every acon at a time and making sure that it's, you know, like a good interpretation of what you're hearing so that the audience kind of feels what it is that we're doing. And then obviously teaching that to a group of people, synchronizing all the movements, making sure the timing is correct, the surface level stuff like styling and presentation is done correctly, and also staging the piece. A lot of times one of my biggest pet peeves in the salsa community is that it's something that I affectionately call synchronized swimming. So you basically have 3 or 4 or 5 couples all doing the exact same thing, pretty much not pooping, you know
right.
What I'm saying? And they're basically just synchronized swimming, and I think that when you have a lot of bodies there's an opportunity to move around and create some more visual interest by making things move at different tempos or having like an accent couple where someone's doing something different or a lot of things. So all that stuff takes a ton of time. You have to really sit there with the bodies. I mean, the bodies are your paintbrushes, and I think the dance floor is your canvas, and I think you really have to take a lot of time to see the bigger picture, and a lot of times that exists in your mind, and the only way to do it is with the bodies in place. So sorry, I hope that answered the question, but it's very involved. It's
absolutely
so much,
right?
To do. Yeah, I mean, a 3 to 4 minute performance to get really ready and super polished, that's about a 5 to 6 month commitment with a solid group of people who are, you know, practicing at least 5 hours a week, you know. I mean, that's
wow.
Yeah, so it's a process for sure.
That's crazy. So like, even when you and Laura are putting together a performance, and I know you do, obviously you're teaching at the school,
yes,
which we'll get into, but I know you're also performing in ballroom competitions, all that kind of good stuff. So if you had a two-minute performance, how much time do you put in before that you put that out there for people to see?
So a couple of, topics on that thing. We've recently decided to, I guess officially, without being dramatic, retire from ballroom competition.
Oh,
yeah.
All right.
Strictly because we came from the salsa dancing world, and when I first started, it was pretty much nothing. There was like one or two events across the country. I mean, I'm really dating myself, I suppose, but nowadays there's events everywhere every weekend, and you know, there's a really big opportunity to be a competitive dancer in the salsa community. And we recently did a contest where it was not 100% favorable to us, but we definitely learned a lot of lessons in regards to the fact that we have transformed transformed ourselves into this really clean, polished couple, but we're also losing a little bit of the essence of what salsa dancing is and what we were doing before, if that makes sense. So
oh, yeah.
There is a little bit of the grime that we got to get back, and I mean that in the most affectionate possible way. I mean, like, you got to get a little bit of street, a little bit dirty with it. And I think in the chase of perfection in ballroom, because you're always looking for the most polished look possible, we lost a little bit of the essence of what we naturally had. And I think that Laura and I are both looking to get back into that. So
you got to get back to dirty dancing to Havana Night.
Oh, my gosh. You should. Right. Right, you know, it's funny, man. I grew up, I don't know, man. I could tell you the list of movies I've seen. They're pretty standard for a guy, but like Laura's like, what do you mean you've never seen Dirty Dancing? You know, and I picked up salsa dancing as my first exposure to dance, so it's not like I grew up in ballet classes or anything. So I just, like, in the past 2 years saw Dirty Dancing. You know, it's not like something that's been ingrained in me, but that scene where they're in the club, you know, in the bar where they're all getting...
Right.
Stuff, that's what we were like before when we were with our company back in the day, and we've lost a little bit of sight of that because we've gone after technique and precision and cleanliness over feeling. And a lot of times it happens. It's natural for dancers to kind of redirect their attention. I think that's a life lesson too, right? We direct our attention to precision and we lose a little bit of that spontaneity that made us, you know, special in the first place. And I think we're, by retiring from ballroom and really refocusing our efforts back in the salsa scene, it's going to get us back in touch with who we are as dancers, and I think that'll present well not only to our community and for our studio, but I think it also for our own personal satisfaction in dancing.
Well, that's awesome. So you're gonna try to find that balance again.
Absolutely.
It sounds like.
Right, because we can kill two birds with one stone. We can still be competitive, but we can still also inspire the next generation of salsa dancers, keep ourselves inspired by producing new work, and just kind of be more creative, because I think the process in ballroom, a lot of people might not know this, is the process in ballroom is to have coaches choreograph for you. So they see your bodies, they see the couple, and then like, okay, here's what we're going to do. Whereas in the salsa scene, it's much more typical for the couple themselves to come up with the piece and show their personal interpretation of the dance versus having a coach put it on you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. So
yeah, I look forward to be creative again in that regard.
Well, and that's awesome. And one of the things I kind of wanted to ask you about, so how long have you and Laura been teaching?
So Laura's been doing it a little bit less than I have, but I've been teaching officially, for about 11 years, 11 or 12 years now.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
And how long have you guys had the studio together?
Officially, we're going on 7.
7 years.
Correct. But Laura's been teaching longer than that. She's probably taught, I want to say, about 8 or 9 years. You know, I've been teaching about a couple years before her. Actually, I want to say I'm like at around 12 and she's at around 9. I could be wrong, but generally.
Gotcha. What is it like running a business? So, I mean, you guys have your own studio, yes. Mixed Motion Arts, fantastic. You know, I'll plug it all day long. I mean, you guys helped me meet my fiance, basically,
yeah.
Right? So you taught me how to move my hips, and I met her out dancing. So.
And your hips don't lie, my friend.
These hips definitely do not lie. They do many things, but lying is not one of them.
I love
Boy Scout.
I love it.
But, you know, one of the things that I know is challenging when you're building a business that's got such a connection to creativity,
yeah.
Right? There's like that whole artistic side, which can be both good and bad, right? When you're just like, well, what are the numbers and are we bringing enough students and stuff like
sure.
that? What has been the biggest challenge for you in building a business that has such a aspect of creativity into it?
Okay, you know, like, I think from a really idealized way, a dancer who wants to open up a studio is always going to, in their imagination, think, I'm going to dance and everyone's going to come and watch me, blah, blah, blah. But they never start thinking, oh, God, I got to go to the city and I got to go get my license and I have to do the taxes and I have to keep my social media accounts going and I have to keep my website polished and I have to keep the class curriculums going. I have to make sure the teachers show up. I have to make sure the classes are all the same, that we keep kind of a system in place so that if for whatever reason someone leaves, we can keep it going. There's a lot to it. So it's beyond our own personal desire to dance, and it's got to be much more systematized and much more efficient as a business. And that's something we've learned over the course of time. So that is the first thing. And the second thing is also that idea of you know, getting people in the door, because for the longest time, we were definitely relying on word of mouth and on reputation. You know, we had a pretty good reputation in the community about being the place, quote unquote, to get better. And while I embraced that with all my heart, I mean, that's one of the biggest honors for me. I also realized that, oh, wow, we got to actually do some marketing, because, I mean, we're going to basically tread water forever if we don't change something, you know. So that's what led me to become more interested in SEO, because I started realizing, well, okay, we're on the second page of Google, which pretty much means we don't exist. You know, we're
right.
Yeah, you know, that's the best place to hide something, apparently. That's like the ongoing joke. You can hide a fortune on the second page and no one will ever find it. And you know, that definitely led me, and it started making me think, like, well, you know, we have to have a bigger voice, a bigger reach. I mean, I've started to keep a blog because of that, and I've started to get really into SEO because I want to I'm proud of what we offer, and I want to make sure that as many people know as possible, so that when they're making their decision about where to go, they seriously consider us because of what we're offering. But if they don't even know we're there, then that's, to me, the problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
So one of the things that I wanted to key in there, you talked about the idea of developing your skills as a business person, right, as
yeah.
an entrepreneur, and learning things. Have you noticed any parallels between learning and of course, teaching others about dancing, mm-hmm. between that and learning how to become a better professional, a better business person?
I don't necessarily think it's I'll put it like this. I wrote a blog a while back, and it's called The Unglamorous. And a lot of times people walk into our studio and they say, hey, you know, I bought a 5-pack of private lessons. You think that's going to be enough to make me good? And then I put it into context. That's ultimately 5 hours, you know, and it took me 14
right.
years. You know what I mean? So what exactly is it that you expect? The purpose of me writing that blog was to basically tell people, look, this is not glamorous. The reason you like the way I dance is because I've done the basic step about 150,000 times, or maybe 200,000 times. Or, you know, I've practiced my spins, or I've worked on my balance, I've worked on my posture. Little things that people don't see that are, you know, like success is not sexy. It's just discipline. It's just repeated a few daily disciplines repeated every day, as a great man once said. So I think that it's not so much dancing and business we're correlating. It's more like that basic principle of life, that I had to be more disciplined in, you know, being a better marketer and being a better dancer and being a better teacher. And I think that discipline and like on a root level is more of the thing that's connecting everything. I hope that makes sense.
That makes absolute sense. In fact, I think you're pointing out what the parallel is between not only learning how to dance or learning how to get better business,
yeah.
but learning how to do anything. It's kind of that idea of being unglamorous, putting in the repetition and learning. I've had people come up and talk to me after I've given a presentation or done a keynote speech,
yeah.
and they're like, wow, you're really good at that. And I'm like, well, I've got about 10,000, or actually I think it's like 12,000 hours of speaking
Jeez.
Experience. If I'm not good at it by now, I've got a big issue.
Right,
right.
And not only that, look at your books. I mean, that's discipline. I mean, that's not necessarily, that didn't come out of nowhere. You sat, you put your ass in the chair, and excuse my language, and you made it happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's a figure of speech, by the way. There's some other guy I used to, you know, follow a lot. He always says the time that you're making things happen is when your ass is in the chair, you know? So
that's absolutely right,
though. Yeah.
There's no secret to
For
it.
Sure.
I have people ask me, not all the time, but I've had a number of people this year go, wow, you wrote 5 books last year. How did you do it? I'm like, I wrote every day.
It's that simple,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always tell people, sometimes, in fact, many of the times when I would write, I would get to the end. My whole thing was like, I had to write a half an hour at least every day.
Right.
Sometimes we're at least half an hour. And sometimes I get to the end of that half an hour and be like, oh, my God, this is garbage.
Did it right? take you more than half an hour to get into the zone? Like, you know, like, have you gotten in flow when you've been writing?
It's a great question. For me, no.
Huh.
Like, I do get in flow. Actually, let me take a step back. I do get in flow, but it doesn't usually take me that long to get there. Mm. It's actually harder for me to maintain it.
I see.
Like, for me, my attention span is really short. And I've definitely talked to other authors who are like, they just love to sit down, they love to have a whole day, and they'll just knock out like 8 hours. For me, some days I had to make myself do 30 minutes.
Right.
But for me, it was also realizing that if I could do 30 minutes, and even if I never got in flow, if I did that every day, I might have a couple thousand words at the end of a couple weeks. then I, you know, I really think that writing is not that first pass through. Writing is really editing, right? You know, anybody can just type some words on a page, but it's when you go back and you kind of to your point, you just slog through sentence by sentence and you're like, is that a good sentence? Does that make sense? And if it does, great. And if not, you're like, nope. Back to the drawing board.
Yeah, man. I think we talked about this briefly before. I've written a book about salsa, but I've had a couple of people look at it, and I finally had someone who's really good at editing take a look at it, and it's pretty much almost one of these things where, okay, you got to do this over again because this is crap. You know, and it's on one hand, it's a little bit deflating, and on the other hand, you understand because you're like, well, look, I want to put something out that's worth reading as opposed to something that I just think is my random gibberish thoughts, you know? So I totally understand where you're coming from, and it does take a little while to let that stream of consciousness happen, for sure.
Absolutely. And so that's interesting. You talk about, you know, an editor. I definitely, for the first book that came out, I hired a very good editor and let her just tear into my manuscript. And it, like you said, it can be hard, especially when she goes, yeah, chapter 5, get rid of it. just axe it.
Damn it.
I'd imagine that feedback. So again, I'm going to think about the creative exercise of dancing, and you and Laura are fantastic. You're so fun to watch. You're so skilled. There's obviously a lot of feedback that you've gotten over the years and probably continue from others and obviously from each other.
Sure.
Does it get easier to get feedback, or does it get harder to get feedback because you're like, I know what I'm doing? Like, does your ego make it easier or harder?
I think I've done a lot of personal development, and I think that has had a really big impact on my ability to take criticism and my ability to respond to it rather than react to it. That being said, the last competition that I did with Laura was like about a month ago, and there was a really prominent judge there, and basically he quite frankly used the word corny describing one part of our piece, and I'm not going to lie, that a little part of me felt really like, you know, a blow to your ego, because it's like, damn, I put so much time into all this. Now, to be fair, we put the piece together in about 2.5 weeks, and then we performed it and competed in it. And in no way, shape, or form did we embarrass ourselves. I mean, it was pretty polished. The thing is, it could have been snazzier. It could have been a little bit more show-offy, for lack of a better way
to
say it. That being said, just him using that word to describe my dancing did not sit well with me. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, on one hand, I take it as, okay, look, this is one person's opinion. This is not a reflection on my ability to dance. This is a reflection on the material that I decided to present. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not about me, it's about it. And it is the material that I've created, and now I need to refine it, not so much me. Now, you know, one of my mentors said to me, Antelor, for the matter, because we were both like kind of pondering on the feedback that we got, and he basically said, look, he didn't say you don't know how to dance. He said you got to kind of snazz up your material. So remember, this goes back to us coming from ballroom back into the salsa scene. So we're fusing these two worlds together, and I think from our perspective, we went a little bit too far in the ballroom direction and not enough back into the salsa direction, which is what prompted our decision to kind of commit in the first place. There's the old part of me was, you know, like, you know, bleep, curse word, that guy, and, you know, whatever. That's just his thought. But the other part of me who's a little bit more mindful now is like, okay, look, I'm receiving the criticism. He didn't say it in a way that was overly gracious or overly helpful or even overly encouraging. He was actually a bit of a jerk about it. But it's my job as the recipient of his criticism to basically look back and say, like, okay, what is actually valid in what he said? Because there's a little bit of truth in everything.
Right.
So I'm taking it. I'm receiving it. I'm doing some self-reflection, realizing, okay, I'm capable of making those adjustments so that my material is received better from the general audience in this world, because he's currently in the world, so he probably knows better than I do, because my focus has been elsewhere for the past 5 years, you know? So, yeah. That's I think, the most recent moment where I've had to really sit back and, like, you know, take one to the gut and sit back and be okay with it and just realize that it was for my benefit as opposed to my detriment.
Well, and one thing I want to point out, because I think this is something that I do myself, you obviously do, and I've seen other successful people do it, is the idea of separating, as you said, me and it, right? He wasn't insulting you as a human being or you as an entity. He was kind of not so keen on what you were doing, right, kind of on the surface level. And I think that's a really important distinction that, unfortunately, a lot of people don't make, right? I mean, I think you could maybe even see that with some of your students sometimes where you're like, hey, you know, that's not how you want to do that. And I know your manner, so you're really relaxed and calm and very easy to work with. But I could imagine some people coming away from a class going, oh, no, I'm not good.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. And I see that a lot, you know, when I teach Zumba classes,
yeah,
for example. And, you know, my approach, hey, if I can do it, anybody can do it.
Sure.
And you're just there to have a good time and jump around, and you can see the people get really self-conscious at times. And, you know, they feel like they're not doing it right. And you're like, there is no right. Just participating and trying is the success.
Yeah.
Well, and you know what? I know that you do a lot of personal development work and a lot of reading and study, as do I. Just quick question. What's your favorite right now? What are you jamming on that's, you know, kind of exciting for you?
So my all-time favorite period, like my man, 50 grand, is Jim Rohn. Like, I...
Old school, all right.
I love Jim Rohn. I listen to Your Best Life Ever. I have, like, it's a four-hour thing on YouTube. I have, you know, ripped the audio, shh, and I put it on my phone, and I listen to that thing all the time, like, all the time. It's just a constant reminder. I quote him so much that people probably get sick of hearing me say it, but I've had to stop saying, you know, like Jim Rohn says, because now it sounds like I'm not even having my own thoughts, but his advice is so timely and relative that it applies to so much of my life and other people's lives that they're kind of sharing with me that it's just the most amazing stuff ever. I mean, I do listen to The Strangest Secret pretty frequently as well. You know, okay. I made it a habit to listen to that, and I listened to a podcast from a guy named Dave MacArthur. It's called The Mechanic to Millionaire. It's a little bit more religious toned, and okay. I'm not going to claim that I'm the most religious guy in the world. I'm definitely getting in touch with my spirituality, and I'm starting to understand the distinction. I think that's a very, I don't want to say cop, but that's not the right word. It's kind of like the token answer for people who don't find themselves to be religious, but there's definitely an element
religious but spiritual.
Yeah, exactly. Right, when people say, oh, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual, you know, it's like I'm finally understanding what that really means, like really just getting in touch with the idea that there might be something greater than us. And there is, you know, I think in The Strangest Secret, you know, he said whatever created this universe didn't make a staircase to nowhere, you know, like just understanding that we have a big role in all this, and I have a huge role in my own success in life and my own happiness in life, and understanding that, you know, and owning up to that idea that it's my responsibility to make it happen and not anyone else's. Like, it's nothing from the outside. It's completely internal. Everything I make happen, you know, and looking at my own results, you know, like, and just seeing what I've, the seeds that I planted and, you know, what's been reaped out of it, and understanding that I can plant new seeds at any given point in time. And, you know, that's what I've been doing lately. And I'm seeing myself be a lot more content and more excited again with what is coming, because I planted the seeds and now I just have to keep watering them and just keep making them grow, because what I foresee coming is exciting and awesome, you know what I mean? So that's a lot of the stuff that I've learned in personal development, and there's a lot of common themes, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Jim Rohn is my number one guy, but there's a lot of people who I've listened to, like Bob Proctor, like Earl Nightingale, you know, definitely old school guys. I'm not necessarily so caught up on the newer guys, because honestly, like Jim Rohn says, you know, fundamentals are old. There's no reason to listen to these guys, because they're basically just rehashing what he said already. You know, and he's rehashing what Earl Nightingale said, and Earl Nightingale is rehashing what Napoleon Hill said, and Napoleon Hill is rehashing. You know what I mean? So if you find a guy that you resonate with, just stick with it, because the information is solid.
Well, and that's what's interesting, because they all, and not in a negative way,
say
the same thing, but it's exactly what you just pointed out. It's just whatever resonates with you,
exactly.
Right? And I mean, that's something that I think about too, in, you know, even what I do, because I'm kind of in this chain of personal and professional development professionals that have gone back for decades and centuries. And I mean, I think it's almost even kind of like where you put yourself in with dance, right? It's like you're part of this chain that, is ongoing, and your job is not necessarily to reinvent, but to recontextualize and make it approachable and resonant for the people in your time period, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome. You said that well.
That was so deep. I don't think I could have come up with that one if I tried. And I'm totally. And I'm glad we're recording. That was awesome.
Yeah, you did that. You just did that.
Nice. Well, here I want to switch gears a little bit. So we can talk about the great personal development people that we enjoy listening to.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I've done in the last couple of years, and this has definitely been as I've gotten into Latin dance and salsa, mambo, all that kind of great stuff, has been the music.
Yeah.
So I've really gotten to love Latin music, even though I obviously don't understand a lot of the words, because even the Spanish I do know, it's just way too fast and colloquial. But some ways that's good, because I don't I don't like a lot of current music in English, because I'm like, oh my God, the words are so vapid. I don't realize that with Spanish language music. But especially like thinking about salsa music or some of the great stuff that's come out in the last, let's say half a century. Who are your favorites? Who are the guys and the ladies that you really, that just speak to you and make you want to move?
So you're giving me half a century. That's 50 years. So that would mean the 60s, let's say. Okay, that's good. In no particular order. I don't necessarily think that I have a favorite, but I think that I definitely have favorites. I'm definitely a huge fan of mambo, meaning a little bit more classic Palladium era stuff.
Okay.
So in that regard, the big three were Tito Puente, Tito Rodriguez, I'll say that in English, Rodriguez, and Machito. So Machito, coincidentally, I named my dog after him. I just thought it was a cute name for a dog. So
that's
my dog,
where Macho came from.
Yes,
all right.
Macho's name, he's named after Machito. That's his government name. Macho is his his everyday name. But
sure.
Yeah. There's definitely, there's so many, like Roberto Rowena, Hector Lavoe, just a lot of, so there was an era in the late 60s and 70s of a record company label called Fania.
Oh, yeah.
N-I-A, and basically, they were known as the Latin Motown, and basically, any of Fania's stuff is awesome. It's just fantastic music, so, I would highly encourage anyone to just look their catalog up, and it's so many artists, and there's a wealth of amazing music out there. It's just so soulful. It really was the Latin Motown. It's a really great representation of the time and also just of really soulful Latin music. I can't get enough of it.
Understand, I just asked you that, so now I have a list of more musicians to go look up.
Good.
I love, and I can't say it with the right accent, but Hector Lavoe.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
He's definitely one of my favorites. And Willie, the trombone player.
Colon.
Willie Colon, love his stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. Those are two of my favorites, but it is so good. It's interesting you use the word soulful, because I think a lot of times when other people think Latin music, they don't necessarily think soulful.
Oh yeah.
They just think the horns and the rhythm and stuff, but it really does have like soul, like, for sure.
Absolutely. There's this one clip, if you go online, when Muhammad Ali fought George Frazier, I believe there's a film about this. The name of the movie is When We Were Kings, but there was a separate movie that was made about the concert that took place at the same time.
So really?
They were in Africa, somewhere, if I'm not mistaken. The Rumble in the Jungle, wherever that happened. The concert had a bunch of really great artists, like Celia Cruz went, and the Fania All-Stars went. And there's a clip of that, I'm pretty sure I'm right here. A clip of that when they have El Ratón, and it's Santana playing. I don't think it's Carlos. I think it's another guy named Santana playing the guitars on that thing. And if you can't hear that song and just be like, oh, golly, that is, that's it right there. You got to look it up.
Well, hey, I know we're getting to the end of our time together.
We're just getting started, D.
I know. And you know what? As I started this podcast process out, I realized how many great people I just wanted to kind of hang out with and have these conversations with.
Yeah.
And I realized that a half an hour is definitely not long enough. So we'll definitely be talking more. You really are a Renaissance man. I love that.
I appreciate it.
And we'll obviously put all the links in the show notes as well. But my last question for you today, and I ask it to everybody, if you could give someone a tip to make today a little bit better, what would it be?
That, that's such a great question. So I think it would be control your state of mind. It just, be present or be mindful of where you're at in your mind. I think it really sets the tone for the rest of the day. Like, you know what I mean? So I told someone recently that I was at a nightclub and I was listening to music, and I explained to them, and I'll say this, and bring this back to your question. I said, sound is vibration, and so are we. And I believe in my heart that we vibrate on the same frequency as the music that we like. That's why we're vibrating towards it. It's on the same frequency. So if you're mindful of your own frequency, I think you're very, like, you can control it and put it in a state where it's very productive and happy. You know what I mean? So my tip would be just to be mindful. Where are you? Like, what frequency are you dialed into? Are you in a negative one? Are you in a positive one? Are you happy? Are you sad? Are you contemplative? You know, like, there's definitely, I think all of us, even on a just instinctual level, know that we're in a negative vibe. You know, whatever that is,
absolutely.
That can mean mad, that can be depressed, that can be angry, that can be, just sensitive to certain things. Like, I think we are all in touch with positive and negative vibrations. So I would just say, really work on controlling your mind and not letting yourself dwell in those negative frequencies so often. Like, the dial is right there. It's literally at your whim. You control your mind. You can literally make that decision on the dime and just say, you know what? Okay, I've dwelled on this for 5 minutes. It's over. Me being negative about this is not going to make it any better, so let's just get back into a positive mind frame. If I can fix it, let's fix it. If it's just something that's out of my control, then it's just out of my control, and there's no reason to be negative about it because I'm just hurting myself from that point in time. So that would be my tip. I think that would be really helpful to people, just to keep that in mind and just,
I love it.
Just be aware, you know what I mean? Be mindful.
Perfect. I love it.
Yeah,
Del, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, my friend. Thank you for asking me. It's been an honor. It's awesome. You're a fantastic person. So I hope nothing for success for you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for stopping by today and listening in. You can find show notes and links for this episode at beerbeatsandbusiness.com. You can also share this episode through social media and leave reviews through iTunes or any of your favorite podcasting services. Do you have feedback? Send DFish a message on Twitter at DFishRockstar. And we'll save a spot for you at the bar for the next Beer, Beats, and Business.
I'm DFish. Thanks for joining us today.
My guess is your next performance will be a little less corny.
Yeah, I don't think our last one was corny either, man.